From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a look ahead to the 2018 midterm elections and Michigan's congressional districts.
It's not just the fact that Michigan went for Donald Trump, but Michigan is also considered emblematic of a lot of industrial states.
Building a community for moms and kids with Detroit Mama Hub.
You know, your family is your family, but, you know, if there's no one in your family that's going through pregnancy and that whole thing, they, you know, just can't really relate.
The Michigan-born opera singer who came out as trans. He began as a mezzo-soprano, but now he's singing tenor.
I have all of this wealth of knowledge of stagecraft and artistry and diction and languages, and the attention to detail that I took as a mezzo-soprano has only helped me as a tenor.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's program, sports commentator John U. Bacon with some advice for the Red Wings coming into the second half of this season.
You either got to double down and try to get them out of the season, or you got to say it's time for a fire sale and let's rebuild.
But first, across the country, Democrats sense a special opportunity in this year's midterm elections thanks to a historically unpopular Republican president and an even less popular Republican Congress. Come November, the entire House of Representatives is up for election. 14 of those seats belong to Michigan. Our It's Just Politics team of Zoe Clark and Rick Pluta are here with us. Now, we're hearing this phrase, wave election, as in, will this year be a wave election for Democrats or will it not? Rick, what is a wave election?
Typically, a wave election is one where individual candidates matter less than the voting public going decisively for one party or another, usually in response to the party that is currently in power.
Okay, pretty much what I set up as we talked about.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, we saw one in 06, right? This was sort of the second midterm of George W. Bush's presidency. Folks were very frustrated with the Iraq War. That's when Nancy Pelosi became the first female Speaker of the House because there was a big Dem wave that continued in 08 for the Democrats. But then in 10, there was the big sort of Tea Party backlash.
There we go. So here we talk about this national buzz. Will this be a wave election year? Zoe, how important is Michigan in this conversation?
Right. Well, so the entire House of Representatives will be up for election in November 2018, 435 seats, of which 14 Michigan owns. So when you do the math, I mean, sure, we got 14 seats. You know, we're not a California population-wise. We're not entirely huge. You know, we used to have, what, 19, 20 in our congressional delegation. So not what it used to be, but hey, we're 14 strong.
Well, plus Michigan gets a lot of attention for having helped put Donald Trump in the White House.
Absolutely. And because Michigan, as this industrial state that had gone blue for six presidential election cycles before going red for Donald Trump, that suddenly put Michigan in the spotlight of, you know, are we blue? Are we red? Are we a little purple? What are we? Who are
we? And Rick, I know you want to add something.
It's not just the fact that Michigan went for Donald Trump, but Michigan is also considered emblematic of a lot of industrial states. Mm-hmm. That, you know, Wisconsin also helped Donald Trump win in 2016. That, you know, we're looking at Pennsylvania, you know, states that are considered traditionally blue collar, a lot of economic focus on industry. Ohio falls into that category as well. And so not only is it that Michigan matters, but that Michigan is also typically part of a trend of decisive states going in one direction or another.
So here we have the 14 seats, three of them with no incumbents here in Michigan. Rick, what sides are forming first for the Democrats?
And what you're referring to is the fact that because these seats are open, that there's a lot of interest in them. And so we're going to see, you know, not just fights in the November general, but also in the August primaries. What we're going to be looking for in the primaries is how are both parties healing their rips? Mm-hmm. On the Democratic side, it's whether or not the Democrats have been able to bring home the Bernie Sanders progressives and have them make peace with the mainstream or centrist Clinton-style Democrats.
And I think that's a really interesting dynamic in Michigan, particularly because, of course, Bernie Sanders won the primary here in Michigan, which I think for many people should have sort of been a, whoa, what just happened? And instead, political reporters and the like sort of went, oh, well, you know, populist agenda, that sort of worked. And then, you know, we shouldn't have been that shocked then that another sort of considered outsider, Trump, then won Michigan in November.
Zoe, what about Republicans? Do GOP candidates in Michigan this year run with Trump or run away from him? What are the pros and cons of each choice?
That is the $1 million, $1 billion, $1 trillion question here for every single Republican. You've got Bill Schuette, who's running for governor, who's kind of still has this Trump bromance, tweeting, retweeting Trump's endorsement of him, a photo of Schuette sitting next to Steve Bannon, who needs no reintroduction now after this
last few days.
And then you've got also running for governor, you know, Brian Kelly, lieutenant governor, who's been a little hands off of Trump. Talking about the congressional delegation, it is going to be wait and see, I think, for a lot of these candidates, which was sort of how it was in 2016. All of them eventually endorsed except for Fred Upton. Upton is running again, but we'll see, particularly in these open seats, I'm thinking especially for the Dave Trott seat, what do these Republicans do? Do they start pushing a little bit more moderate? The problem with that, of course, though, is the primary. And that's where the real conservative activist voters come out. So what do? You kind of lean to the right before the primary, then try to push back for the general. And this is going to be, like I said, the million, billion, trillion dollar question for Republicans right now.
Let's look at the three Michigan districts that do not have an incumbent, starting with the 13th district. No representative now that John Conyers has resigned. Rick, is there any opening at all here for a Republican?
Absolutely none. That the respected Cook Political Report calls that a D32 district. And that means that district is so Democratic that the Democratic nominee starts out with a built-in 32-point advantage. It's one of the things that happens with gerrymandering, is that you try and pack as many of the other side's voters into as few districts as possible. But what you wind up with are super partisan districts.
Rick, what about the 9th, now that Sandra Levin is retired? Hiring. Is that also, is it going to, it leans Democrat, right?
That is a D4, which means that there's a 4-point advantage. And so that would be a leans Democratic district. And so in theory, in the right year, Republicans should have a chance there. But it doesn't seem to be one that Republicans, at least at this juncture, are looking at making a strong run at, because they're playing defense in so many places in Michigan and across the country. That if you look at the number of toss-up seats across the country, I'll go back to Cook's, Democrats, four toss-up seats. Republicans, 17. And that just expands out in the, you know, in the leaning seats as well. So Republicans are just playing a lot more defense, not as many opportunities to go on offense.
Zoe, what about the 11th district where Dave Trott's decided, I'm done?
Yeah, so that's sort of the opposite, if you kind of, you know, inverted the parties.
Yes.
In the 11th, where Dave Trott is the Republican, said no thanks to a third term. There appears, if, you know, if Democrats were looking at a seat, you know, and salivating, that might be one. And again, that goes with sort of that Democratic wave if that happens in 2018. There's a possibility. It, of course, depends on the candidate, how much money they can raise. And again, turnout.
That's the big challenge for Dems.
That one is the one in Michigan that's considered a true toss-up seat.
Exactly.
Okay. And what about the Republican incumbents in Michigan most vulnerable to being picked off by the right Democrat? What names come to mind, Zoe?
So I would say Tim Walberg and Mike Bishop. These are both Republicans in seats that, if the Democrats had the resources and the you know, wherewithal, that that's where they would focus.
And a wave.
But again, part of this goes to Dave Trott now open, which seems a little more doable. In some ways, Walberg and Bishop might be thanking Dave Trott for getting out of the race, putting more Democratic resources into that seat. But Tim Walberg's seat in those waves that I was talking about in 06, 08, and 10, those went back and forth. Walberg won it in 06. Mark Schauer won it 08. And then Tim Walberg won it back in 10. So that's one to watch, although that district has changed a little bit with redistricting in 2011.
And Tim Walberg has succeeded in redistricting, in getting Calhoun County and Battle Creek, home of his political nemesis, Mark Schauer, and in the primary, Joe Schwartz, living in someone else's district now.
Indeed.
What about the first, Rick? I mean, Jack Bergman won the race, but didn't Democrat Lon Johnson kind of give him a run for the money?
He sure tried, but you know, the reality is that the first congressional district is Trump country. And Jack Bergman will run as a Trump loyalist. And the expectation is that if there's any place in the state where Republicans can turn out the Trump coalition once more to win in November, that it's the first.
Back to the expectations and Democratic hopes of a wave election. So we talked about what Republican candidates, the decision they're facing, and how close do you tie yourself to Donald Trump? Rick, what about for the Democratic candidates? Is calling, for example, for the president's outright impeachment, is that fraught with its own political risks?
Yes, and that is one of the controversies within the Democratic coalition. How much time are you, you know, it's look what happened to Hillary Clinton, that she spent the campaign largely running against Donald Trump. And there are a lot of Democrats who say within that path lies peril. That what Democrats need to do is they need to tell voters what they are going to do for them should they win a majority in the House or the Senate or both, and not merely set themselves up as foils to Donald Trump.
Zoe, last word, what do Michigan Dems need to be mindful of to try to make this a real wave election?
Exactly what Rick said, and then again, turnout. That it, you know, in Michigan, there are more Democrats. We know this. The fact is they don't turn out, and they particularly don't turn out in these off-year, you know, elections, in these midterms. And so that's really, you know, they got to fill up the buses. They've got to, you know, carpools, all of these things, and get people to the polls if they're going to have a chance, particularly in Southeast Michigan.
Rick Pluta, Zoe Clark, our It's Just Politics team, as always, thanks so much.
Thanks, Cindy.
You bet.
Up next, a new indoor velodrome could put Detroit cyclists in future Olympics. Then we learned about Detroit Mama Hub. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Take one impossible dream, add an angel donor who has deep pockets, and what do you get? An impossible dream that comes true. In this case, a new indoor velodrome that has just opened up in Detroit's Midtown area. This makes Detroit one of only three U.S. cities to have a specially designed facility for indoor bicycle racing. And its designer believes this velodrome could put Detroit racers in future Olympics. Dale Hughes is executive director of the Detroit Fitness Foundation, and he designed the new Lexus Velodrome. Dale, you have designed velodromes all over the world, including the one used for the 1996 Olympics in Atlanta. How long have you wanted to build one in Detroit?
Well, really, it goes back about 40 years. When I first built my very first one, which was a portable velodrome, we were not able to have the funding that we have for this project, and this one is really a dream come true.
So describe this new Lexus velodrome that opened in Midtown Detroit, just how big it is and what it has and how it can be used.
Well, our facility is under an air structure, so you think of it like a golf dome. It's 64,000 square feet, so it's the size of a football field. And inside we actually have what we call three fields of play. We have what we call the ET Oval, which is a flat concrete floor oval, which is about an eighth of a mile. It's named after Eddie Tolan, who won two gold medals in the 1932 Olympic Games, and our park is named after him. So we have the ET Oval for running, walking, inline skating. We can also have health fairs. We can have art shows. We're going to have a free senior walking area for seniors to come in and walk like they do out in the malls in the suburbs. Then we have a world-class cycling track, which is called a velodrome. That is a tenth of a mile. It's 15 degrees in the straights, and it goes as steep as 50 degrees in the turns. Riders will hit speeds upwards of 40-plus miles an hour. And we'll have riders that will be as young as 6 years old riding on it, and we've already had an 83-year-old who was racing on it. Then the third field of play is our infield area that we can have fitness classes, spinning classes, and host graduations, weddings, all kinds of alternative activities.
So it can be for the youngest and oldest members of the community right to the most elite athletes.
You're exactly right. We're in a city park. Our agreement with the City of Detroit and the Parks and Recreation Department is to provide upwards of 8 hours of free programming for kids and seniors. So we're going to have field trips in the morning, field trips in the afternoon, and an after-school program for the kids. And those are all free. We'll have the bikes, we'll have the skates, we'll have the helmets, we'll have the shoes, everything. We'll have the coaching. We do have a lofty goal of seeing if we can't get a young woman or a young man who may have never seen a velodrome in their life and get them onto the 2020 Olympic Games, for sure the 2024 Olympic Games.
Well, you know what? You've got the facility for them to train, don't you?
We do have the facility, and actually Detroit has a history, too. The Olympia Stadium was built in 1927, and one of the very first events they held on it was what is called a six-day bike race, which was on a velodrome that they built just temporarily in Olympia Stadium. And over those 6 days, 40,000 Detroiters went to see the bike races at Olympia Stadium. And then in the 70s, we had an outdoor velodrome near 8 Mile and the edge of Detroit. That velodrome produced over 125 national champions, and it produced three world champions, all women. And the three of them, over a course of 10 years, won the gold medal in track racing. So we know we have the engines. We now have the facility. We have coaches. So we're looking forward to seeing if we can't have some new champions.
And I've seen price tags and in stories about the new Lexus Velodrome, around $5 million for this.
Our complete facility is just under $5 million, correct?
And my understanding, tell me if I'm wrong, there are zero taxpayer dollars put into this.
You're exactly right. This was all funded through our nonprofit. No taxpayer money was involved. We have a 12-year agreement with the City of Detroit. Basically, we paid for it. We have to operate it and provide the free programming and provide the programming for adults, too, again, at no cost to the taxpayer.
And you had an angel donor that kind of waved a magic wand, didn't you?
We had our founder came in and said he wants to do something, especially for the kids of Detroit, was his vision. And our mission statement is fairly simple and clear, to provide fitness and sporting opportunities for area residents with a focus on youth and seniors.
And who is your founder?
Well, he really just doesn't want to be known. He's not doing it for any kind of personal glory. He's a Metro Detroiter who has lived here most of his life, grew up here, was blessed, and sort of wants to give back to the city.
It'll be great to watch as the community uses it and also to see if there's any Detroit name in the 2020 Olympics or, as you say, the 2024.
You know, I think the key things for your audience to understand and follow is we're going to have regular Friday night and Saturday night races. And the races will have our local kids racing, but we'll also be bringing riders in from around the country and around the world. So we're really going to have a world-class facility here that is going to showcase world-class racing. So on Friday night and Saturday night, we expect to fill the house here.
Dale Hughes, Executive Director of the Detroit Fitness Foundation and the designer, obviously the very proud designer of the new Lexus Velodrome in Midtown Detroit. Thank you so much for being with us, Dale.
Thank you very much. Look forward to seeing everybody here.
Collaborative.
Experimentation.
The next idea.
We need a participation revolution, and we need it fast.
It is fair to say moms can use all the help they can get. Family and friends, of course, can step in. But what about things like getting lactation advice or finding support groups, programs for kids, and most of all, finding other like-minded mothers? Some metro areas seem to have a lot of resources, but today's two guests on The Next Idea connected over what they felt was a real lack of community among mothers in the city of Detroit. The result?
Detroit Mama Hub. It's a community offering support and education to moms and to kids. The motto is Motherhood is Better Together. Jalynn Spencer-Harris and Alex Flugel are the founders. They're both with us now. Welcome both of you to The Next Idea.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
How did you two come up with the idea of founding Detroit Mama Hub? What was the spark?
Well, back in 2013, when I was pregnant with my daughter, well, I had moved back to Detroit a few years before that from Baltimore. And I also have a 17-year-old son. And I just noticed that, you know, just a big difference between Baltimore and Detroit as far as the types of support that was available to me as a pregnant woman at that time. And it just kind of frustrated me. I felt like, you know, Detroit moms should have those resources available to them that I was able to easily take advantage of when I was in Baltimore.
What kind of support were you looking for that you weren't finding?
Well, in terms of like prenatal fitness classes, childbirth education, things like that, but also just having a supportive community of other mothers who, you know, were going through the same process of being a new mom and just wanting that support. I was in Baltimore. I was I didn't have any family around. You know, the people that I connected with ended up being like my second family. So even though I was back home in Detroit where I was born and raised, you know, your family is your family, but, you know, if there's no one in your family that's going through pregnancy and that whole thing, they, you know, just can't really relate. So I was kind of looking for that. Didn't really find a way to connect with other mothers. So that's kind of how the idea came about. I kind of put it in the back burner. I started a Facebook group in 2013 just to try to start a community online of moms in Detroit. And then 3 years later, I ended up applying to a Motor City Match Award for a business planning program, and I ended up winning that award, and that's where I met Alex. She was part of the BUILD program, which was the business planning class that allows entrepreneurs to grow their ideas, their business ideas, and create a business plan. That's where we met, and, you know, through our discussions, we found that we were both had ideas for serving moms kind of in different ways, but she wanted to support moms who were co-working and freelancing and give them support in that arena. And so we decided, oh, I think maybe we have something here where we could kind of bring the two ideas together.
Alex, you came to Detroit from Grand Rapids, correct?
I did.
And so were you surprised at the lack of support for moms when you came to Detroit?
Well, I was looking for a different kind of support when I came here. My daughter was 2.5, so I was really looking for opportunities to meet other moms, meet other kids, meet other families. And I did find that Detroit does have a lot of easy to find free opportunities, a lot of great cultural resources where you can take your children there and meet other families. However, I didn't find the support I wanted as a working mom. I was freelancing when we moved here and I wanted to find flexible work space and childcare. And that was really difficult for me. The options were pretty limited to full-time care, traditional business hours. And so I kind of had to find my own way in that regard. And that was where the spark came for my idea of creating a space where moms could co-work, have very flexible hours, and find additional resources that support their lives as professionals or working moms or entrepreneurs.
So you found each other and the result is Detroit Mama Hub, which is what exactly? I mean, is it a brick and mortar place where folks come or is it a series of initiatives? Just exactly what is Detroit Mama Hub?
Detroit Mama Hub is a community that offers support and education to Detroit moms and families so they can thrive. Right now, we're not a brick and mortar. We've been collaborating with various local organizations and businesses to hold our groups and classes and events over the course of the last, I would say, 6 months or so. We've had meetups in places like Pony Ride, which is a co-working space. And we've collaborated with other small businesses that support families like Kids Kingdom and Little Dumplings. And this month, actually, we have started a new partnership with the folks over at Fort Street Presbyterian. They're going to allow us to use their space to offer more regular groups on a weekly basis. So we're really excited about that. And so while we're just really trying to build that community and let mothers know that this space exists where they can meet other moms and learn from each other, and eventually we do want to find a brick-and-mortar space
where we can hold a more comprehensive types of classes and services.
Alex, what's unique for the kids in terms of what you're offering? What do you want them to experience?
Well, we want them to experience being invited into spaces that are traditionally considered for adults only. So kids are welcome to attend everything that we offer. All of our support groups have always been open to moms bringing their children of any age. When we did the co-working series during the fall, that was the moms went upstairs, they worked in the co-working space, the kids were downstairs, but the mothers were welcome to come up. The kids got to see this is a place where our moms come to work. We really want to encourage places that, like I said, are not traditionally thought of as kid-friendly to be welcoming children into those spaces. So the kids also get to meet other children. They get to have fun. They get to be with their moms. The moms are there meeting other moms, and the kids are doing what kids do best, being curious, having fun, and learning a lot.
And Jalynn, you also are able to hold a breastfeeding support group?
Correct.
Because you are also a lactation consultant. Talk to us a little about that.
So I've been working in the breastfeeding support arena for about the last 4 years and recently became a lactation consultant. And so I just felt like that's a huge part of new motherhood, you know, is trying to get that right. And I think all moms need breast support. There is some breastfeeding support available in the city. There's an organization called Black Mothers Breastfeeding Association that has been really good at giving moms in the Black community a place to go and get that support and community. But you know, I just wanted to offer something for everyone, something that is still culturally sensitive and inclusive, but just offers support for all moms. You know, breastfeeding can be challenging. Even though it's natural, it can be a very challenging process to go through, and you know, that peer-to-peer support is just really huge in helping moms reach their breastfeeding goals. So just want to offer a space for that.
I want to talk a little about the two of you as a team. I know, Alex, as you told us, you came to Detroit from the west side of Michigan. Jalynn, you were in Baltimore for a while. Now you're back at home in Detroit. So we've got two people from opposite sides of the state working together like this, and also you're different races from each other. So what do those differences bring to this project and the two of you as a team? And I'll let Alex start with that.
So Jalynn and I are different in many different ways. Like you just mentioned, we're from two geographically different regions, which are not great in distance, definitely different in makeup. We're from different races. We're also different ages. We have different family backgrounds and experiences. And although we have all of these differences, we both have daughters who are 4 going on 5. So Jalynn and I have connected over having children that are the same age, and it's been really great because it's allowed us to be able to talk about our differences, talk about our shared experiences, and learn about another person in general with that, I guess, that central focus on we have our babies and we're also dealing with a lot of the same issues. So it's been a really fantastic experience, getting to know another woman, getting to know another mom, and building the kind of relationship that we hope Detroit Mama Hub will build between many mothers across the city.
That's what strikes me, Jalynn, is what you and Alex are doing is what you want to bring to moms who come and become part of Detroit Mama Hub.
Exactly. And we come with different strengths and weaknesses. You know, I have a science background. Alex is a writer, so we have the whole left brain, right brain thing that, you know, really helps to kind of balance what we do. I feel like you were saying that, you know, we envision Detroit Mama Hub offering other women this type of relationship, you know, where you can have your differences and have a safe space where you feel like you can express the things that matter to you and get that support. And I feel like I have that with Alex, you know, even though she may not understand my experiences as a Black woman, but she strives to understand and she's sensitive to that. And I feel comfortable talking to her about that and just a whole host of things that I might be going through. And that's what we want for Detroit Mama Hub moms.
And your moms are busy. What would your advice be to other women around Michigan who are hearing this and saying, you know what, we should try to start something like Detroit Mama Hub? What would you say to them, Alex?
I would say reach out, take risks, and be the first person to say hello. That's the biggest thing. Be the first one to say hello. If, you know, Jalynn and I hadn't said that to one another in the business planning class, this wouldn't have happened. And it does require, you know, a bit of courage. it's hard to make new friends when you're an adult and have children and, like you said, you're busy. But also look for resources that are out there. Do a little bit of digging. Things do exist, and if they don't exist, create them yourself.
And Jalynn, I bet I can hear the determination that you will have that brick and mortar spot where you can really build a regular series of programs and meetings and activities.
Absolutely, absolutely. We recently won a Motor City Match Space Award, which is going to allow us to start looking for spaces and, you know, just navigating what's available and how to, you know, build a good relationship with the landlord and things like that. And so we are definitely looking to have that happen, you know, hopefully within a year.
Well, you can learn more about Detroit Mama Hub by going to their website, which is an easy one to remember, DetroitMamaHub.com. And we've been talking to co-founders of Detroit Mama Hub, Alex Flugel and Jalynn Spencer-Harris. Thanks to both of you for sharing your work with us on The Next Idea.
Thank you so much for having us.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
Still to come, the trans opera singer who went from mezzo-soprano to tenor.
Being a mezzo-soprano has brought me quite a lot that I never would have been able to see if I had been, for lack of a better way to put it, born as a tenor.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Time to talk sports as we say hello to Michigan Radio sports commentator John Eubacon. And John, we've had some listeners reach out on Twitter and put in a request, talk some hockey, and we aim to please. And the timing is perfect. It's the midseason mark. So last night, the Wings lost to Tampa Bay 5-2, which is what happens when Tampa Bay plays the Red Wings. Wings lose.
Because the Lightning are better. That's why.
The Wings were on a four-game winning streak until last night, and now they've got a few days' break. So tell me what you think about where the team is right now in the season.
They are 17-17-7. They are perfectly mediocre, as we had about predicted. It's almost exactly where you don't want to be, because they're not competing for any kind of, you know, Stanley Cup chance, any of that stuff. But you're also, they got five or six great guys coming out in the draft this year, and you're not anywhere near that either. Mediocrity will perpetuate mediocrity. It's better, actually, in the pro system to drop down to bottom and get somebody good and rebuild.
Okay, there we go. And so let's do a little lightning round. I'm going to toss out some names, and you can tell me what you're liking or not through this first half of the season. Jeff Blashill and his coaching staff.
Average coach with an average roster.
And that is a surprise, because you really
I was very big on him.
Yeah.
And maybe I'm wrong, and I'd love to be wrong, but not yet.
Okay. Jimmy Howard.
One of the best goalies in the league right now. And he is a professional. His defense is pretty weak, and you never see him complain about them, which is pretty, that's how a big boy handles his business.
Peter Mrazek.
A very talented goalie who's trapped.
How so?
Because he's getting behind Jimmy Howard. Mm-hmm. When he's hot, he's as good as anybody. When he's cold, he will complain about the defense. That's the problem.
Okay. Dylan Larkin.
Really talented guy who is now in his third year on the league. Mm-hmm. And guess what? They all know your stuff now. So his goals have gone way down. You're going against the big boys, the top line. He's not quite a top liner, but he's in that role.
Oh, and he is leading the team in scoring.
He is, but he's got like eight goals.
Yeah,
so.
Okay. Andreas Athanasiou.
Head case.
How so?
$1 million arm, 5 cent head. That's your boy right
okay.
there.
That's why you get such uneven.
He's got a ton of talent, and he's alienated his teammates, and he's not a gamer.
Okay. Captain Henrik Zetterberg. Talk about ageless.
And the opposite. This guy is hardcore. He's Yzerman. I mean, he'll block shots. He'll kill penalties. He's a consummate Red Wing, a consummate team leader. Love that guy.
What are you looking for as they move into the second half of the season, which will start on the 13th when they play the Penguins in Pittsburgh?
Sounds crazy, but you got to go one way or the other. You either got to double down and try to get some out of the season, or you got to say it's time for a fire sale and let's rebuild.
Okay. Over to Tom Izzo, Spartans, the number one team, falling to Ohio State yesterday, 80-64. What went wrong?
Some nights the shots don't hit, and what they shoot, like 39%?
Yeah, 39%, second lowest percentage of the season.
Exactly. Look, in baseball, the bats will go cold. In hockey, you run into a hot goaltender, you can't score. Okay. Every sport has got this, basically. One situation where you can't win no matter what you do. In this case, the shooting hands went cold. And look, here's how you break it down. Behaviors and results. If the behaviors are good, the results will get there and usually stay there, but occasionally you're going to take a step back. Izzo's a very, very smart coach. He will blow this off. They played hard. They played smart. The shots were not landing. Blow it off. Move on.
There's a time to haul people to the woodshed.
And that's when the behaviors aren't good. Okay. So if the results, even if the results are good and the behaviors aren't, they're not rebounding, they're not hustling, they're not passing the ball and so on. And Bo is a genius at this, Bo Schembechler. If you beat lowly Indiana by a touchdown, you will not like Monday. If you're in a dogfight with Ohio State and you lose, gentlemen, I'm proud of you. Because you gave me everything you could, and that's how you handled that one.
Is there a difference between the approaches you take with professional athletes versus student athletes?
No question, although the smart mix them up a little bit. Okay. Student athletes, guess what? You're not going to trade them. They're yours. Whether you like it or not, they're yours. It's going to be yours for 3, 4, 5 years, chances are, and their emotions do matter. So when Berenson, for example, Red Berenson at Michigan, moved back from the NHL to the college ranks, it took him a few years to realize, you know, these are not the same kind of guys I deal with at the NHL. Scotty Bowman, as you and I have discussed, was not too concerned about your feelings.
No, I don't think your feelings, man.
And did not have to be.
No sleep was lost at all.
We are paying you, right?
Okay. College football championship game is tonight. I got Alabama versus Georgia. Nick Saban going for his 6th national title, which if he gets it, what? He would be tied with Bear Bryant for the most all time.
That's as good as it gets.
Yeah.
Which is why I'm pulling for Georgia. Go Dogs. But, man, betting against Alabama is like betting against IBM in the heyday. It's just not a smart bet. Alabama is my bet here.
All right. So we'll all be watching to see that. And hearing anything on Lions coaches' interviews?
My strong hunch is they'll get a coordinator from the Patriots because Bob Quinn is a Patriot alum, of course. The guy's going to make this call. And that will be a good decision if they can nail one. So I like that idea very much.
Michigan Radio Sports commentator John Eubacon. As always, thanks, John.
Thank you.
And if you missed any part of today's show, you can find it on our podcast. Just go to michiganradio.org and click on podcast, and there's the link. Here's your choice. Continue on your journey to becoming a professional singer using the voice you were born with, or risk losing that voice and possibly your dreams and career in order to live an authentic life. And that is the choice opera singer Holden Madaugamy faced. He trained at the University of Michigan School of Music, Theater, and Dance as a mezzo-soprano. That recital was recorded as Holden, who was assigned female at birth, was singing as a mezzo-soprano. But about 4 years ago, Holden came out as trans. And after a difficult and risky journey, here is Holden today, a tenor. Holden Madaugamy is with us now via Skype from Germany. It's a pleasure to welcome you to Stateside, Holden.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let me quote from a piece that you wrote about yourself for Britain's Independent. And here's what you wrote. I'm 27, Native American, queer and transgender. I'm also a tenor who used to be a mezzo-soprano. So your love of singing, serious singing, goes back way before you came out as trans. Now, you grew up in Gaylord?
Yes, I did, yeah.
And when and how did you discover opera?
It's a funny story because when I was a kid, I really wanted to be a video game designer, and I didn't plan on singing at all, but a choir teacher roped me into the choir class because I played a bit of piano, and I found out that I was good at it. And so I took some lessons with the choir teacher at our high school. I became very quickly obsessed with everything to do with music, conducting and theory and opera specifically, because she gave me an aria from an opera. And it just kind of went from there.
What do you think it was about opera that grabbed you? It's not everybody's cup of tea.
I think what it was about opera is, I think it was the stories and the characters, which you can get from theater, and you can get from musical theater, but it's the kind of sweeping emotion that underlies everything that these characters have to say. It's so much more than what they're saying most of the time. Half of what they're saying is in the orchestra, and that's what I found really exciting.
And so there you wind up at the University of Michigan training as a mezzo-soprano. Describe for us just exactly what a mezzo-soprano voice is. What's the vocal range?
Sure. So a mezzo-soprano is a lower female voice range. So a soprano is the highest. Mezzo-soprano sits a little bit lower, but often has the exact same range or a very similar range to a soprano, but they just sound better in a little bit lower range. And a really good example of a mezzo-soprano is Lady Gaga. Even though she's not a classical singer, she is a very good pop singer, and she has kind of a lower female range. That's a really good example of a mezzo-soprano in popular culture.
So there you are training away, graduated, right, from the University of Michigan. Your first professional performance after graduating from U of M was what?
My first professional performance was The Marriage of Figaro with Arbor Opera Theater, and I played Cherubino. It was my dream role at the time. I'd been wanting to do that role since I was in high school. So it's kind of a dream come true.
In the meantime, you've got these other changes taking place in your life and realizing that you wanted to come out as trans. And that was a risk, wasn't it? Because of your voice and the way you wanted to make your living and what that would mean to your voice. Talk about that.
You're exactly right. It was a huge decision to make because at the time when I was deciding to come out as trans, deciding whether I wanted to take testosterone, which was the first huge decision I wanted to make, there wasn't really any research as to the effects of testosterone on the classical singing voice. There had been a few articles on the internet, and I had kind of talked to a couple of people, but the conclusion basically was that I wouldn't be able to sing anymore professionally. But I basically didn't accept no for an answer. I talked to some other teachers, and there was one teacher at the University of Michigan that I sent an email, and I was just in a bit of a state. And she replied very calmly, and she said, "Holden, I think you should just go ahead and do it, and maybe you'll be a tenor." And how exciting is that?
And that was such the right thing at the right time, wasn't it?
Absolutely. It was exactly what I needed to hear. I needed someone's permission, really, because I was scared.
And then you found the place to find your tenor voice, the Glyndebourne Academy in the UK. Talk about that place.
The Glyndebourne Academy it's a very new program. It's basically for singers with non-traditional career paths. And everybody comes from different places financially and experience-wise. Everybody has a different story, really. And Glyndebourne itself is really a world-class international opera house. As far as I'm concerned, it's the highest standard of opera that we can come to besides the Metropolitan Opera in New York. They're really at the same level, but very different places. The Glyndebourne Academy is a place where I think 9 singers could go and basically get some tender love and care to their voices, their artistry. We talked about acting and body movement, dancing, how to work in a chorus, how to learn music correctly, Italian diction, English diction, stylistic things, all sorts of things. And primarily I was looking for vocal technique help because I'm going through a major voice change.
And you had this new tenor voice that did not have the skills that you had when you were training as a mezzo-soprano.
Exactly. It's a completely different instrument, to be honest. I still have a lot of the same abilities, and I was a good student, and so I know how to practice, and I know how to look at technique, but it's kind of starting from the ground up.
And you did, and you found your tenor voice, and you are now singing as a tenor. How do you feel now? There are very few artists that can say, "Well, I was this, and now I am that." What do they lend to each other? Like, what did being a mezzo-soprano and being able to attack a role that way, what did that bring to you now as a tenor?
That's a very good question. I think being a mezzo-soprano has brought me quite a lot that I never would have been able to see if I had been, for lack of a better way to put it, born as a tenor. Because as a mezzo-soprano, I'm mostly focused on the tone of my kind of lower middle range. I focused a lot on diction. I focused a lot on stagecraft and artistry. I of course, focused on the voice, but it was really different. But now as a tenor, coming from that background of being a mezzo-soprano, I have all of this wealth of knowledge of stagecraft and artistry and diction and languages, and the attention to detail that I took as a mezzo-soprano has only helped me as a tenor. I don't just think about what my high notes sound like, which of course is important too, because those need to sound pretty.
Sure.
There's so much more to it. And I'm so thankful that I had the experience of not having to worry about high notes as a mezzo-soprano.
So as you begin to make your way into the world of being a professional opera singer, things are happening, right? You've got some roles lined up for 2018?
Yes, I do. Well, I'll be singing a little role called Wenzel in The Barter Bride. And that'll be, I'm doing an opera festival and we're doing that, the full opera. And then in October, I'll also be singing in La Traviata in London. So that's very exciting.
And you did look around very hard, didn't you, for anyone in the opera singing world who had done what you wanted to do, you know, to take testosterone. And you look for trans male singers. And so you didn't find anybody. So are you feeling that sense of really forging a path, a new path?
I really am. Yeah, it's a bit scary. I didn't want to admit it for a while. I was like, oh, there must be other people out there, which I think there are, but I just I couldn't find them. They weren't visible to me. Nobody had come out as a trans singer in my field at the time. So I really think I'm the first one to do it so publicly, at the very least. And I think I'm really, like you said, paving the way for other trans singers who want to go into opera. I already have emails and messages from young trans singers who are just so thankful that I exist and that there is an example of someone that they can be, you know?
Because when you're facing that choice, well, you didn't really feel there was a choice, right? Because you could not continue to go on the way you had been. You felt you did have to make this transition, and you knew you were masculine. So you had to do it. So you were willing to risk the voice.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There wasn't a choice for me because the quality of my life and the quality of my mental health was so poor that I wasn't singing anyway. I was so depressed and dysphoric and unhappy with my gender that there was no other option. I wouldn't have been singing at all if I'd continued that way. So
you rolled the dice and you won, because now you have this beautiful tenor voice, and it is absolutely a beautiful, beautiful voice. And is there a point, like right now you are out sharing your story, you're talking to us here, you wrote this terrific piece for The Independent, telling your whole story. Is there a point where you'll be glad to just be Holden Madagame, the tenor, and not the trans opera singer who went from mezzo-soprano to tenor?
That's very astute. Yes, I think at some point I'll get to that point, and I'll be very happy to be at that point. For now, I'm very happy to also be sort of, for lack of a better way of putting it, the face of trans masculine opera singers, and happy to help other people in that way. But it'll be nice when I'm not the trans opera singer when I go into an audition, you know?
Opera singer, tenor, Holden Madagame. Good luck with the productions you're going to be doing in 2018 and with your opera career.
Thank you.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings and engineered by Bob Scon. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Danny Hensel, Sarah Leeson, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening. We'll be right back.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.